WTIC, it's after 6. Michael Leibowitz is here, our favorite Connecticut resident and our favorite resident of the Connecticut penal system. How are you, Michael?
I'm doing well today, Todd. How are you?
Nice to talk with you, as always. So you heard a segment that we did on the show recently talking about what?
Okay, a guy named Ezra Klein said, I guess, that...
We'll play the cut. If that's how you're going to set it up, let me just play the cut, and that'll make... So Michael heard this and wants to react to it. Here we go.
I don't know. Like, I think the best argument for why you should not have poverty is that it's in a rich society, it is unjust to have poverty.
Sure.
And it's not the way you want to construct it. And I really feel this about child poverty, where I'm just like every day. I mean, this is again, I sort of want to credit this argument to my wife, who makes it more eloquently than I do. But every day you have child poverty in America is a day you are choosing to have child poverty in America. Like, it could end tomorrow. And, like, we have chosen that, like, children are going to be in poverty. And, like, that is not because they don't work hard enough. And it is not because, like, they did bad in school. And it's not because they have done anything to deserve it. It is because we have chosen to let them languish there.
All right. So we have decided in a rich society to let our kids languish. I guess the idea is we're letting them languish in poverty because we're hateful and cruel. But go ahead, Michael. React to it.
Okay, well, there's at least 4 flawed premises I find in his statement. The first one is when he says, in a rich country.
Yes.
Because countries are not rich. Countries are not wealthy. Individuals are wealthy. People are wealthy. The fact that you may be wealthy has nothing to do with me. It's not my money. But his idea is that it somehow is our money. So right away, he starts off with a collectivist premise. That because money happens to be generated, or wealth happens to be generated in a given geographical area, it belongs to everybody living within that area, which is flawed off the bat.
All right, let's talk about that point for a minute before you go on to others, because I think I'm going to try to channel him to some extent, and I think what he would say, maybe, is that even though you're technically correct that each person has the right to their own earnings, we also have a government that we fund. And we fund that government in order to find the equilibrium between taxation and government redistribution and individual rights to pursue what they want. So some people would argue, for example, that providing free daycare for children would create a more productive society, that for those who are out there trying to produce, that we enhance their ability to do that by having more government investment in that particular activity. How do you respond to that?
Well, first I would say that the start of your argument was that, well, we already do this for other causes, so why not do it for this one? But then there's a sudden shift that took place in the argument, and this happens frequently when debating people. And that is, he started off with a justice argument, which is a moral concept. This is unjust that this is the case. And then it switches to utilitarian pragmatic argument, which is, oh, but if we do this, it will benefit everybody. So I would say first that if we're going to argue, let's pick our terms. Are we arguing the utilitarian aspect, or are we arguing the justice aspect?
Well, which one do you think is the stronger argument in opposition to you?
I think that both of them are extremely weak, actually. And as we go through the 4 premises, we'll get to them. And so I think it'd be easier to do it that way.
Okay.
So the second premise he has that I think is flawed is that poverty is unjust, especially to children. Now, the first thing is that he doesn't define what justice is and what is its source. Now, justice to me is what an individual chooses to give to another person. For instance, I treat you how you deserve to be treated. So justice is a moral concept in the sense that it's based on the idea of desert, what one person owes to another. But he doesn't define it. He just throws it out there. And a lot of times, and this is not my argument, by the way, this is Friedrich Hayek's argument against the social justice, is that a lot of these outcomes in economy are the result of a myriad of people choosing different things. For instance, you know, a bulk of people may like a given soda, or a bulk of people may like a given pasta or given clothing. They're by no means choosing, you know, that they want to reward the manufacturer of that product. They're just choosing to buy a product, and it ends up making another person wealthy. that would not be a function of justice in the sense that I think that Ezra Klein is using the word, where I'm making a choice to benefit somebody or I'm personally giving somebody something that they deserve. And in that sense, I don't think that these kids that he's talking about that are in poverty either deserve or don't be in poverty. I think they just are in poverty. And then there's the other thing too, Todd, just kind of as an aside, is that poverty is a relative term. I mean, the average poor person in this country, they have TVs, they have automobiles, microwaves, things that, you know, a couple hundred years ago would have been, you know, the unthinkable luxuries, but now we consider them to be in poverty. So they keep changing the benchmark of what poverty is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that kind of complicates the discussion as well.
Okay, what's your... So your first point is that the rich country argument, and your second is the notion of justice and poverty and where exactly does the line lie. What's your third objection to Ezra's argument?
This is the one that really sticks in my craw, and that's that one person's need creates an unassumed obligation in another person to do something about that need. Now, you may choose to help, and that's fine. I mean, that's your choice. But if I fall down the stairs right now, because I'm on a staircase, does that create an obligation in you that you must do something about it? You must, you know, call an ambulance or call the jail and say, Michael Leibowitz is falling? I don't think so. I think it would be nice of you to do, but I don't think it's an obligation, and I certainly don't believe that you should be compelled to do so. But that would even not be, to be honest, a good analogy, because you and I happen to know one another. I am talking to you on the phone.
Well, I assume you meant a hypothetical where we have no connection to each other. But the thing that...
That would be a completely different story.
The thing that would be mitigating, I would think, on this argument would be if it's of no cost to you. So if you're there and you witness something and all you have to do is make a phone call that isn't taking anything from you, what's wrong with compelling people to do that?
Well, for one thing, I would take issue with the idea that there's no cost, because it assumes that cost is only financial. But cost is any action that you take, because any action that any human being takes comes at the expense of anything else he could be doing.
Okay, so you wouldn't even have a reasonableness clause in that statement. That's an absolute. Nobody has a right to expect anything from anyone else.
Except for that other people do not violate their rights.
Okay.
That's it.
All right, what's your fourth point?
Okay, this gets kind of into what you said before at the beginning. And this is the idea that government redistribution of wealth can solve the poverty problem. And often those of us who aren't for the government doing something are accused of lacking compassion. But the very thing in argument here is whether the government can actually do this, whether they can actually solve the poverty problem. Ezra Klein in that clip says we could solve it right now if we wanted to. Really? Is that based on the myriad of successes that we've had with government programs in the past? I think like $6 trillion has been spent on anti-poverty programs, and we still have them.
Yeah, so this is my primary objection, is the assumption that because we're a rich country, that means we should violate our principles and change the structure of our country in order that we can create mechanisms to do things that might make us an unrich country, as we have learned through the implementation of these programs. I say this to people all the time when they repeat this platitude about healthcare, that in a country as rich as ours, and I repel at that phrase as well. It doesn't matter how rich we are. The reason we are so rich, the reason there is so much wealth in the hands of individuals in our country, if you prefer, Michael, is because we have a system that doesn't subscribe to the premise that would say we should do stupid things, destructive things like having universal health care because of the quantity of money in the possession of our citizens.
Yeah, because then that's going to lead to less money in the hands of our citizens.
Yes, a poorer country and one in which the plunderers have more of the power. And the reason we have a reasonably successful country is that through most of its history, we didn't allow the plunderers to have such huge control as we do today.
Yeah, there's actually a chart, and I don't know where you can find it, but it shows world GDP growth throughout the centuries. And it's basically flat. And then when it hits the point at which capitalism was unleashed, it just skyrockets.
Yep.
So it goes from a flat line to basically a vertical line. It's very...
You have 1 minute left.
Okay. I will look up that chart. That's interesting. All right, Michael, reconnect. Michael has a 15-minute maximum per phone call, so he will reconnect and we'll continue the conversation.
The caller has hung up.
Continuing with Michael Leibowitz, talking about the Ezra Klein clip that we played earlier. He is a he is a political reporter and a co-founder of Vox.com. He does a podcast, and I played a clip of the podcast where he talked about how wealthy we are, and despite our wealth, he says, as Americans, we have chosen to have child poverty. So we're breaking down Michael's objections to the arguments put forward by Ezra. Do we have all of Ezra's arguments responded to?
I think we do. I'm going by memory, but I believe so.
Okay. Sorry, go ahead.
Were you able to find that chart I told you about?
I found a chart that starts in 1961. I'm trying to figure out if it'll go back further or if I've just got the wrong one. But what did you want to say about it?
Well, it's just an interesting thing to look at. If you could find it, you can tell your readers where to go to find it.
Oh, okay. I've got it now. So, it was pretty flat from the year 1270, this starts, per capita in England since 1270. And then in 1925-ish, or 1918, say, it starts to really take off. Basically flat for hundreds of years, and then just shoots up to, you know, multiples, exponential hikes over a small period of time.
Are you sure it's not 1818?
This one, you know, there's a lot of different ones on the internet. This one is, you mean when it takes off?
Yes.
Well, it starts to gradually go up in the early 1800s. But actually, in the 1700s, it starts to sneak up a little bit. But it doesn't actually make outrageous gains. For example, 1921, GDP in England was £4,800. £4,800. And then we advance to 2008, and it's £30,000 per person.
Okay, so that's not the chart that I was talking about, but I still think it makes the point that with capitalism comes extreme growth, when throughout history we've had relatively flat growth. And that's kind of the point that we're getting at with these guys that make the argument that we could solve poverty just by implementing their plans. And if you don't want to implement their plans of destruction, you must, you know, be some kind of cold-hearted monster.
But the big government crowd would come back at this, Michael, and they would say, you may be right in absolute terms, and obviously it's a judgment call what is poverty and what is not poverty, and therefore there's a lot of gray area in what ending poverty would mean, or maybe even ending poverty wouldn't be our goal, but mitigating it to the extent at which we would find that young people would all have relatively equal shots at life. And we could decide as a society that even though we want to be a capitalist society and we don't want big government programs, that we benefit as a collective if we invest in children, giving them a fairly even start at life. What would your objection be to a softer argument than the absolute one that you're objecting to?
See, my problem is I'm going to go a little bit out of the zone of how I would defend it, because even if what you're saying is true, I would say it doesn't justify violating the rights of people in order to make other people more comfortable.
Uh-huh.
But as a purely practical matter, if somebody were to say that to me, I'd say, prove it. What is the evidence that you have that says that you can accomplish what you're saying you can accomplish? What has government ever done so successfully that makes you think they could tackle a problem like poverty and handle it better than the free market has? I can point to the free market and demonstrate how it's lifted people out of poverty. I can show how average lifespan's gone up for all citizens, even the poorest of the poor. Can they do the same? Can they show their government program that's done the same? I don't think so. And just to kind of, you know, the government agency that I'm most familiar with is the one that I live inside.
Yes.
And it's the Department of Corrections. And the interests here are so entrenched. What ends up happening with these organizations, like assume that you were to create a Department of Poverty Reduction, right? Well, then you have people that come to depend on that for their jobs. They work there. And then it might not be in their interest to actually solve the poverty problem, because then they go out of business. So it's now in their interest to keep it so. Similar to which, the people that work in the DOC, or Department of Correction, if they solve the crime problem, assuming they could do so, they'd all be out of jobs. So where's their incentive to do so? And the interests end up becoming entrenched. They get paid regardless of performance, and you end up with a 60%, I believe, recidivist rate, which is what we have now. And that's been my experience in going to the DMV on the street. It's been my experience in what I've read about other government agencies, and I don't see why it would be any different with the Department of Poverty Reduction.
Well, I think that's a really vivid point that everybody should be able to relate to if they could believe the facts. For example, I do agree it's a shocking bit of data to understand that in the first 3 years out of prison, 60% of prisoners, how do you use that word, recidivate? Is that a word?
The term is recidivism.
Yes, but how do you...
Yeah, they recidivate. What they do is recidivate, yeah.
Yeah, so that's a pretty shocking thing. What that means is we're okay at putting them in a cage and taking away people's rights, i.e. punishing them for a long time when they deserve a long sentence. Sometimes not. Sometimes we let them out too early. As a matter of fact, it seems like we always let them out too early, because they're more often than not hurting someone again almost right away. In other words, they can't leave prison successfully. And that seems to me has to be a failure of the idea that we can have a successful criminal justice system.
I reluctantly agree. I would only say the one thing with the idea of letting them out too early is the evidence for that is the recidivism rate. The problem is that the Department of Correction is not doing what it's supposed to do in order to bring down that recidivism.
But that's your point. I'm just throwing that out there.
I just don't want to leave it, because it's so easy to blame criminals. And warranted, that's what you're supposed to do. I mean, we're criminals. We violated people's rights. We deserve to be punished. But at the same time, I don't want to give the impression of absolving those whose responsibility.
Yes. No. I think it's an incredible thing. There was just an incident where Jeffrey Epstein, this rich guy who's in prison, was either somebody tried to kill him in prison. He's only been there, I don't know, a week or two, and or three or whatever. And the other part of it was they thought maybe it was a suicide attempt, and they don't know which one. Now, either way, that's a failing of the prison system, but it's never seemed appropriate to me that the government can be responsible for putting people into confinement, i.e. taking away their rights, and then allowing them to be physically abused while they're there. But anyway, we're not talking about prison reform. We're talking about the failure of government to run any of its programs successfully. And I think that's fair. I think that the government does precious little very well. And so this is where I'm with you. Let's listen to that Ezra Klein cut again for people who missed the beginning.
Okay.
And just make sure they understand what we're talking about.
I don't know. Like, I think the best argument for why you should not have poverty is that it's in a rich society, it is unjust to have poverty.
Sure.
And it's not the way you want to construct it. And I really feel this about child poverty, where I'm just like every day. I mean, this is again, I sort of want to credit this argument to my wife, who makes it more eloquently than I do. But every day you have child poverty in America is a day you are choosing to have child poverty in America.
So that's his argument. The kids didn't do anything wrong to deserve this, and yet we hold them in permanent poverty. And Michael Leibowitz's answer, and I agree with him, is that we don't have the ability to fairly and efficiently provide a product that would deliver affluence or comfort or whatever the threshold we would seek. We don't have the ability to deliver that product to these people, and taking the money away from people who are going to work every day in order to do it is an affront and destructive, ultimately.
Yeah, I've always thought, Todd, that what a scam it is to come up with the idea that stealing money from some to breed dependence in others is compassion. That's a hell of a hoax.
Well, you know, if you were to not call it stealing, because that pejorative casts it in a light that's a little too negative for most people to take. The most people accept.
I didn't know you were part of the politically correct crowd.
Well, no, I'm just trying to. I'm trying to mitigate their concerns with your argument. I'm letting you play bad guy and me play good guy here.
Oh,
so,
okay.
So the good guy says, "Oh, but we can have a better world if we just give up little bits of what we earn in order that everybody can have a better shot." And then they would even say, and Ezra would say this, Ezra Klein would say that. In order to allow those who are super productive slash wealthy to be able to successfully live in a society where they get to keep large amounts of their wealth, that you can't pull that off if you're not redistributing some of the wealth so that there isn't so much resentment and disparity of wealth that the society falls apart.
I believe that we've got 230 years of evidence, I believe that's how long it's been since the ratification of the Constitution, that proves otherwise. And, you know, the thing that always kills me about this is if they're so concerned about it, why don't Ezra Klein and other apostles of altruism, you know, the Hollywood left and, you know, the entire liberal crowd, why don't they just give away the bulk of their money to charity?
Well, because they know what Democrats don't tell us when they attack the rich, which, and that is that there isn't enough money in the hands of the rich to be able to take the amounts away that the government wants to take to do any of this stuff successfully over any significant periods of time. So they throw up their hands and just say everybody should have to do it. But most of it's posing, I think, anyway. I can't imagine that they believe that squandering all their hard-earned money and taking away the capital to invest in businesses and in new movies or whatever, that would be a better society.
Well, I think it's just a cop-out. It's easy to just say, oh, look, I'm compassionate. I don't actually have to do anything. I don't have to think. I don't have to solve the problem. I just say, oh, just take money and give it to poor people. That'll solve the problem. Despite, again, the fact that there's zero evidence that I'm aware of that actually works.
Michael Leibowitz is a prisoner in the Connecticut penal system. He is a regular here on After Six. He appears every week, and we love your segments, Michael. Thanks so much for continuing to do this.
Thank you, Todd. It's a real pleasure for me.
Stay tuned. Clark Howard coming up after news on WTIC News Talk 1080.